Welcome to the Food Professor Podcast, episode 12. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, Sylvain, living in the Atlantic bubble, it's starting to get some international news. I see on, I think it was on CNN, they're talking about the Atlantic bubble as a success. I know you've and I have shared, you've shared that it's a mixed blessing. In other words, you feel safer. Life is, I think, as you shared, is a little more normal than, you know, Quebec or Ontario, for example. But there is a trade-off to be made, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm concerned about the future. For now, of course, we look good. Things are great. And to be honest, Michael, economic numbers aren't bad, but we're in October. I mean, I think the worst is yet to come. So we'll see how things go. But I'm very concerned about the economy overall. It's going to be quite the challenge, I think. And the reputational risks also. I mean, I know that people in Quebec and in Ontario are looking at the Atlantic bubble saying, well, because we're diseased that we are not worthy, and I'm hearing some of that as well. So I'm hoping that it's not going to impact the reputation of our region, because we have so much to offer, especially for tourists.
Well, and I guess it's interesting you comment we're heading into October, because I would think that the region has not a whole lot of tourism in the winter months. So I guess in some ways I would think strategically you've got the winter months to figure it out as a region. In other words, you got to come out, figure out if you're going to continue this bubble, everything from the cruise boat season in Halifax to all the wonderful places in the Atlantic provinces in the spring when tourism really kicks up, right? You've got,
exactly.
The big thinkers have got some thinking to do.
If the bubble had to burst, it had to be in July, because I think everyone knew that that a second wave was looming. Yeah. And it does scare. What's really interesting is that based on the numbers that we see, the fear factor is equal on both sides, inside the bubble and out. People are as fearful of the virus than people in Quebec and Ontario and elsewhere in the country, which really makes this thing very interesting, because it doesn't necessarily mean that you're in the bubble that you're less fearful. Fear is just bad for business.
All right, well, let's move on and let's talk about some recent studies you did with the dairy industry. So you and yes. The team have been very busy. Great studies. I read them both, as I always do. I find your work so interesting. So let's start with the big study you produced in conjunction with, I think, was it Guelph?
That's right. Absolutely.
On the dairy industry managed supply. So there's a lot to unpack in that survey. I mean, from that Canadians are essentially paying twice for their dairy because of managed supply. But also it was really, to my mind, a call out to save the industry. And so, you know, in one way, it came off as initially as this criticism of, again, is this our tax dollars well spent? But really, I thought ultimately it was all about how to save the industry. So talk about your observations and you know, what you learned and what your recommendations were coming out of the research.
Yeah, so I've been at this for 20 years, and of course I've always been critical of supply management. I don't think that it's a secret. For many years, I've also said that I'm not necessarily in favor of abolishing the system either, because we are north of a superpower called the United States, and frankly, if we get rid of our quota system, I suspect that we would get flooded with American milk. I mean, that's just economics.
We'd be overwhelmed. Yeah,
absolutely. So I was always asked, well, what's the solution then? And so I've been trying to figure that one out for many, many years. And along with the University of Guelph, with Simon Somogyi, my good friend there, we basically decided to lay out a 20-year roadmap to help save the industry. Because right now, on our current path, we could lose half of our dairy farms in Canada. But not only that, in processing, we could actually see also processing being affected. You're seeing Saputo, even agropreweries investing outside our country. And so basically the roadmap is about how to grow the industry instead of just managing a declining scenario. That's really the key. That was our key message from day one. It is really to help dairy farmers and processors as well.
And who do you hope reads the survey? Like, you know, we had Senator Black on a couple of episodes ago, fantastic interview. Is it, like, at what level can that kind of 20-year vision really resonate? Who do you hope reads that survey and starts to do something about it?
Well, on the same day, on the day of the release, we actually did have a call. We did get a call from Ag Canada. So we actually had a discussion about what we have in mind. I mean, nobody has ever bothered to look at a scenario, to look at an opportunity to grow the business beyond the rhetoric that we've heard for many, many years between the two camps. You either had people supporting supply management or people who wanted to abolish it. But there was no one in between, really, because it's such a polarizing issue in the sector. And so that's why I think the report got some attention. I mean, despite COVID, I thought it was actually pretty good. We did get a lot of attention as a result of the roadmap itself, and so we're still seeing articles coming out this week about the roadmap. It's getting people to talk. It's getting people to think. What's really, and I did say that to our friends over at Real Ag out west. As soon as you start hearing that some parts of the country people are saying that the roadmap did not go far enough, and in other parts, in Quebec, they're saying that the roadmap is going too far. Well, my guess is that we got it right. We're allowing a conversation to happen, a dialogue. This roadmap is purely theoretical and academic.
But it provides a framework for dialogue, right? Which is exactly. I think your point is that was missing. Is like, you said it's a polarizing issue. How do you even start that discussion around issues that are such. So in my mind, as you said, it provided this framework for at least people talking about the issue.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, the fundamental principle of the roadmap is to basically invite producers to exit the industry who don't want to compete. And that's fine. And the other thing, the most important one, is to actually reform the CDC, the Canadian Dairy Commission, which is a crown corporation owned by all Canadians. But nobody knows about it. Nobody understands what it does. And right now we're on the verge of seeing yet another bailout, another payout given by the federal government to dairy processors, dairy farmers, probably $1.8 billion, and processors are again forgotten. And that's the whole piece here. Dairy processors need to be protected as much as possible.
And that bailout is a result of some of the agreements in the new CUSMA agreement, right? In the new cross-border agreement. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, and these they're positioned as compensation packages, but they're not included in the pricing formula run by the CDC. They're just gifts.
You're just over and above.
Making a difference in terms of how the industry can compete moving forward. And so to me, it's just wasted money. And I suspect that dairy farmers will do other things than just focusing on their business. And that's unfortunate.
Well, I can tell you as a consumer, I always look, whether it's in cheeses or butters or anything, I look for that dairy, Canadian dairy, Ontario dairy. I want to know that my product is being made in one way, shape, or another here. So I think it fosters I think there's fertile ground, in other words, to kind of continue to move that forward. Now, we jumped right in. I forgot off the top. I seem to be forgetting every episode. Really. It's not my first time. To tell everybody, we're going to have a very special guest with a great interview. Julie Denton has joined us
right.
from Recipe Unlimited. She's actually wearing two hats. She's wearing her chef's hat, so to speak, with Recipe. And then she also is on the board of Restaurants Canada. So we get into a great discussion about policy, what can be done at an industry level. So stay tuned for that. Sorry, I just wanted to kind of talk about that. Now, back to local. You did another survey, which again found very interesting, and you know, I was thinking about my own behavior, and the research was about kind of a couple of different dimensions. Will people pay more for local? What do they think about product and how it's produced locally? I'm you know, my first inclination is always to look for local where and when I can.
What is local to you?
Well, local to me is Canada, Ontario, then Canada. Like, I guess it's a circle.
It's the province of Ontario, Okay.
Well, I guess I'm less fussed about did it come from my, you know, from a grocer in my region. I guess if I had a choice to make on three dimensions, is it from my region, is it from my province, or is it from the country? I'd kind of in that order. But I'm really kind of I'm an agnostic. I just prefer it comes from Canada. You know, if it was dairy from Alberta, lovely. If it's dairy from Quebec, lovely. I'm less fussed about that. Really, it's a matter of degree, but I'm very focused to the degree I can be on understanding that the dairy products are from Canada. So, I mean, that's my personal perspective heading into it. What did you learn in the survey?
Well, the meaning of local will vary depending where you live.
Mm-hmm.
and that's why I was asking. You're in Ontario. The majority of Ontarians actually will consider a local food as a local grown and produced in their own region. So if you're from Peel, it has to come from Peel. If you're from Wellington, it has to come from Wellington, and so on and so forth. And so that
you think that's because of are people thinking about that from that's my neighbor producing that, or it's the, you know, it's a shorter trip on a truck. Like what is it that pragmatic?
I think it's about the physicality and context. Mm. I think those are the factors. Whereas in the Atlantic, if it's made in Canada, we're good to go. But there are for Quebec, Ontario and BC, it's all about regionality, which I thought was very interesting. And most programs that we've seen in Canada promoting local foods, organized and supported by provinces, often they'll always consider the market as being highly homogeneous. So like I remember Foodland Ontario, for example. I'm not even sure if it's around still. Foodland Ontario consider Ontario as an homogeneous market. Didn't matter where you're from. In Quebec, it's the same thing with Aliment Quebec. But I actually would say that that clearly came out of our surveys that people will see local different. The other thing, of course, that we noticed, and that's probably the most important part of the report, is that people do want to support local. They even want to pay a premium for local, 75%. However, what we've also noticed in our study is that Canadians aren't hardwired to look for local foods. Because you see, in a survey, they'll say, yeah, absolutely, I want to buy local. But when life kicks in, and you got 25 minutes to do your shopping, you have a budget, and then, of course, local becomes less of an issue. What is top of mind for a lot of Canadians, of course, price, aesthetics, freshness. Those factors are actually more important than provenance. And that's why we felt it was important to recognize that, because if we are to give a fighting chance to local products, well, we got to get rid of the most important barrier, which is price.
Well, I also think it was interesting to me. I saw onions as one of the top ranked, I forget exactly the context, but it was up there in terms of things that people are looking for local. And I got to think about safety. I mean, one of the reasons I like to buy Canadian is because I'm very confident that it's safe. I'm very confident that the grocers manage that well. So, you know, it's all relative, but you know, onions, right? We recently had a lot of problem with onions coming from the US particular farm. So where I can, I'm looking for Ontario Canadian onions. And it's interesting that kind of popped up in your survey as well. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Food safety is a big issue, of course. We have seen our disasters when it comes to food safety in Canada.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of maple
like we're
leaf.
We're certainly not immune for it. But we seem to have less of the, not cholera, but we seem to have less of the issues around the fruits and vegetables from the bad water issues.
It's hard to compare because we don't have organizations or our productions with the scale that you would find in California, for example. That's why when you have a problem in California, it impacts the entire continent. We don't necessarily have that in Canada. That's why we tend not to hear about recalls as much, or at least class one recalls, which are typically national in scope. Right. And are more dangerous. And so that's the reality of Canada. But what our suggestion is to make sure that if we are to invest more in control environment agriculture projects in Canada to produce food all year round, we also have to make sure that we do build economies of scale to actually allow grocers to buy products at a good price, at an interesting price, to carry food all year, Canadian-made food all year round. And in the survey, we actually saw that Canadians really don't care if it's grown in greenhouse or conventionally. They see it as high quality regardless.
Yeah, that was interesting to me. I think maybe I'm old school, but I think fresh on a farm on the ground is better than greenhouse. But, you know, again, only a matter of small degree. Like if I had a choice between the two identical at the same price, I'd go fresh in the ground. So it was interesting to see, and it's good to see those perceptions changing, because of course we are a northern climate.
You know, exactly. And so there's no prejudice towards greenhouse grown produce essentially. There is a bit of I think food service, like chefs, are a little bit there, they're not as keen with greenhouses. They want to showcase a story to their customers, you know, that feel out there.
Factory to fork.
The bucolic aspect of agriculture, I think, is important for them. So there's some of that going on in food service, but at retail, Canadians are willing to buy anything local as long as it's decently priced.
Well, great insights. I'll put a link to both studies in the show notes. So I encourage all the listeners to check them out. They're both great pieces of work. And I think you did the first study you did with Guelph. The second was with cattle, right?
That is correct. And we're actually working on a new project for mid-November on e-commerce. So as we know, since the start of COVID, a lot of people have actually ordered food online. We're trying to understand how many people have actually ordered online since the start of COVID, how many people are still doing it, and how many people are planning to do it in the future.
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, right? Measuring the what we'd call the great acceleration, the number of people who adopted e-commerce. And it is really more important to understand how many people are going to continue, both from grocers and from restaurants, right? That's literally the billion-dollar question. So that comes out, I think it's November 12th, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. So I'll look forward to that. Again, it's answering one of those very important questions around the future. You know, I wanted to call out a stat for you. I was doing some work, actually for the folks at UGI doing a presentation, and I was trying to think about downtown cores and the impact. I found, get this, 10% of the people who used to come to the downtown core of Toronto, and I'm sure this is the same in the major metropolitan areas, 10% of the people are there versus pre-COVID. So in downtown Toronto, 200,000 people would come and go to the main towers. That's now 20%. Sorry, 20,000 people. Can you imagine?
Oh, my God.
Like, we're starting to actually put numbers to this. What a transformation, right?
And it's not just in Toronto. And that's why you got to think again about your strategy overall. I mean, downtown cores are going to be serviced differently. Suburbia is going to be serviced differently. I mean, telecommuting is a huge factor. People working from home is going to be a huge factor. It's going to change a lot of things.
Well, I was thinking back to our interview with Solange from Club Coffee, and the recent results from Tim Hortons that kind of highlight the coffee industry is feeling the brunt of this and really will need to adapt and innovate, right? There's just, you know, so many people who would just by habit go grab a cup of Tim Hortons on the way into work, and they're just not there. Like, they're just physically not there.
So yeah, no, absolutely.
Challenge. Well, listen, why don't we jump right into our interview with Julie Denton, Senior Vice President of...
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, let's have a listen. Julie, welcome to the Food Professor Podcast. How are you doing this morning?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael and Sylvain.
Sylvain, you and I talked about early in our... the genesis of the podcast, how we'd love to get both a restaurant operator and someone from Restaurants Canada. And we've got a BOGO here, buy one, get one. We've got Julie who's here representing both.
Well, thank you.
Julie, why don't we just jump right in? Tell us a bit about yourself, personal journey, professional journey, and your role at Recipe Element.
Okay. I am the Chief People Officer at Recipe Unlimited, so many Canadians would know it historically as Cara Foods. You know, I feel very fortunate. I'm accountable for all things people. You know, I think being in the hospitality industry and having a mandate for people, you know, is one of the best jobs somebody can have. You know, I'm responsible for talent attraction, employee engagement, you know, culture and values, talent management, leadership development, you know, occupational health and safety, which is now at the forefront with COVID, and training and corporate communications. You know, I graduated, you know, from a biology degree at Dalhousie and went on to do an MBA at Rotman. And I feel very, very fortunate that I've had the opportunity to work both in consulting and in industry. You know, I started at KPMG Consulting, you know, and I've worked for iconic Canadian companies over my career, like Barrick Gold and Davis and Henderson. But I've also had the opportunity to work across industries. So having, you know, worked in public sector, fintech, healthcare, and mining, you know, I think that's allowed me to bring a lot of different innovation and different ideas to hospitality, and in particular to this role. I think the one common thread, you know, throughout my career has probably been the focus on human capital. You know, if I think about leadership and employees and engaging in the employee experience, I think that's really been the common thread and what I'm excited about, you know, being at Recipe.
Well, and you and I have something in common. Actually, we should give a shout out to U of T Rotman MBA, because it was they who connected us, actually, just through the alumni network and thought we should. Yeah, it was so shout out to the strong alumni network.
It's a great alumni network. They're very engaged, and I think they've done an excellent job at reconnecting people.
So set the table for us, so to speak. Tell us about Recipe. As you said, I grew up with it as Cara and Cara Foods, but it is not the business I knew and grew up with 20 years ago. It's quite the business. Take us through it, because I think many Canadians listening and people around the world would be very familiar with the brands, but not necessarily understand Recipe as the company powering those brands.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Recipe as its own identity or own brand doesn't have a lot of brand recognition. But when you look at the underlying brands, you know, we are Canada's largest full service restaurant company. We've got brands from quick service brands like Harvey's and New York Fries. We've got family casual and casual brands that people would know, like Swiss Chalet, Saint-Hubert in Quebec and Ontario, Montana's, Kelsey's, Pickle Barrel and a catering division, you know, Eastside Mario's, Original Joe's, State and Main. And then we get into pubs and social like Elephant Castle and Finn McCool's. Most recently, we added some brands Anejo and Blanco, which are newer concepts for us. They're, you know, fun, authentic Mexican cuisine and a great tequila lineup. And then we're in the premium category as well. So with the Keg, you know, Milestones and the Landings. It also includes Burgers Priest and Fresh, which many would not think of as part of, you know, the broader Recipe family. And most recently, a brand called Ultimate Kitchens. And Ultimate Kitchens, you know, is an aggregation of lots of brands and a ghost kitchen concept.
I really want to dial into that one. And you work, I believe you have restaurants on both sides of the border, right? With Elephant Castle, is that correct?
We do, exactly right. So we've got 1,300 locations, you know, 840 franchisees, 60,000 associates across the network.
Wow.
The ghost kitchen concept is fascinating. We're hearing more and more of about that concept. Is this something that you're expecting growth from as you look at your business, as you look at how to expand your footprint as an organization? Is this something that is going to be a priority over the next few years?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a priority before COVID. And as we look at it now, I mean, when we set out our strategic plan back in January, we shared with our team members what we plan to do to grow this. And now more than ever, you know, we see the value. I think for us, what's really interesting is, you know, it's multiple brands under one roof, but these are brands that Canadians trust. You know, these are brands like Swiss Chalet and Harvey's and New York Fries and Eastside Mario's. And when you bring those all together under one roof, I think it's great for consumers. It's giving them choice and variety, but they're also brands that they've come to trust. And, you know, with 60 and 65 years between New Harvey's and Swiss Chalet, like those are brands that Canadians have come to trust. And I think trust is an important pillar right now through COVID.
Oh, absolutely. There is certainly one brand I'm very familiar with. As someone from the province of Quebec, I was actually quite, the most surprising acquisition that I've seen coming out of your organization is the one with Saint-Hubert. Jean-Marc Léger is a friend of mine. I've actually interacted with him on several occasions over the years. And when you guys acquired Saint-Hubert, the entire province was in a state of shock. but I did argue that Cara at the time, you guys were Cara. I thought that Cara was a logical choice or a logical company to actually become the caretaker of Saint-Hubert. So, but that acquisition was really, I thought, was really fascinating. Is it part of your growth strategy now to acquire, or are you focusing more on organic growth coming from your different divisions? Because you have so many of them, it's incredible. Your portfolio of brands is just overwhelming. Are you focusing more on organic, or are you focusing more on acquisition, or both?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, our history is to grow through acquisitions and, you know, Harvey's and Swiss at the start, and then more recently, Saint-Hubert and Keg. So it has been historically through acquisition. You know, we do focus on organic growth, you know, within the context of our, I would say, within our strong brand. So we're always opportunistic with looking for units that make sense relative to where our customers are. But I would say if we think about, you know, next steps for us, you know, continuing to look at strategic acquisitions will be a key area of focus.
We have to talk about the big elephant in the room, COVID. I'm sure your life has changed since March. It's all over the news. The restaurant industry has been severely affected by COVID. So we're curious, Michael and I, to get your thoughts on COVID. How have you experienced COVID since March as an executive of Recipe Unlimited?
You know, I think as Recipe, I mean, one of the things that we are, I would say, proud of is, you know, one of our core values is do the right thing. And we knew that at the core of this, you know, we needed our franchisees to come out successfully on the other side. And so, you know, at the beginning, you know, we actually chose to close our dining rooms and our restaurants before it was mandated to do so. You know, we were keeping our eye through the World Health Organization, everything that was going on, you know, across the globe. And so we felt that that was the right thing to do. And we quickly worked to put programs in place to support our franchisees. So we had, you know, COVID websites that we set up specifically, one-stop shop of all the resources a franchisee would need to understand the programs, the loans, the wage subsidy programs, rent relief programs, regional municipal programs that were available to them to help them try and navigate, you know, through everything that was happening. Because as people know, announcements were changing daily, weekly, monthly. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is, as a leadership team, we met daily. We had cross-functional SWAT teams focused on safely closing restaurants, but more importantly, focusing on reopening restaurants. So we put together a blueprint. We put together a business certification training program to retrain all of our associates on how to handle PPE, masks, making sure they understood that they had paid leave. We gave them thank you pay to recognize their efforts, you know, through all of this, and really made sure that as much as we could, we helped bridge them through any federal program or federal supports that they needed. And, you know, I'm really proud of how we as a leadership team, you know, handled it. At one point, you know, with 60,000 associates, we had almost 49,000 originally laid off.
Wow.
And now, yikes. You know, we've been able to, you know, call that back and really be able to recall, you know, associates, retrain them, you know, make them feel, you know, safe and secure, and as much as possible pivot, you know, whether that's curbside pickup, delivery, takeout, you know, like every other independent operator, we really had to make sure that our brands that were not omni-channel brands now had other channels that they could use to operate to really survive.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So what's your situation right now? So you had 60,000 associates going into COVID. Where are you at right now overall?
Well, so with regards to some of the regional shutdowns, so aside from regions that are shut down, and most of that's, you know, really in Ontario and Quebec, you know, we've been able to recall everyone except for those areas. So, you know, we would be at about 75% in terms of staffing right now. We do have a lot of stores and 22,000 associates in Ontario. So with regional shutdowns, Ontario and Quebec, you know, that will continue to be, you know, a challenge until those are reopened. You know, Quebec just announced, you know, an additional 28 days yesterday. So as long as the regions, you know, continue to experience regional shutdowns, you know, unfortunately, that does challenge our ability to recall everybody.
No, absolutely. I've been constantly impressed by the resiliency of the sector. To be honest, it's just been amazing. There's been some successes amid COVID, and certainly your organization is one of them. So I do want to congratulate you for that. It's been unbelievable to watch. It's been challenging, but at the same time, I've been impressed by how entrepreneurs, how businesses have been able to cope with this virus and the impact.
Well, I appreciate that. I think this is a great example where I think people might have thought that this was a sprint, and now this is, you know, a series of sprints.
It's a marathon.
You know, and it's exactly, and as much as it's a marathon without a definitive end in sight yet, you know, if we really look, it's going to be before we've got a vaccine en masse, before I think we're going to see people back together socializing in the way that they have in the past.
It's what Sylvain and I have been referring to as the COVID era. You know, that kind of ill-defined end point of whatever we're in. And I'd echo Sylvain's observations around execution. In fact, this past weekend, I had a socially distanced first golf day, so to speak, with a few friends, and we ordered Swiss Chalet as soon as we got back to my outdoor heated thing that I've got back here, and it delivered. It was delicious. It was the perfect solution for us. So congratulations, well executed, and kind of a one off. The only thing I wish is that I could get Saint Hubert. I grew up with that. You know, I'm from Ottawa. Yeah. I grew up with that. You know, it was a real treat for me and my parents to go to Montreal for the day. And when we went to Montreal, we went to Saint-Hubert.
Our cottage is in Saint-Sauveur, Quebec. And the first thing our kids ask when we go back to Quebec is to stop at Saint-Hubert every single time.
It's a healthy debate in our organization on which sauce you prefer.
And then there's a debate in our family. Are you a dipper or a dunker around the sauce? But there's lots of things going around that. Around that sauce, right? So, Van, do you pour the sauce on, or do you dip your food into the sauce?
I'm a dipper.
Julie, what about you? Do you dip or you dunk? What are you?
I'm a dipper.
I'm a bit of an outlier in my family. I just pour it all over, and I just order extra and pour it all over.
For the salad, for the coleslaw, it's cream, not traditional. So that's the other debate going on there.
I get a little bit of both.
Well, I mean, it's clear you've got icon brands. I want to pick up on a couple of quick things just to bridge us over to talking about this BOGO idea that you're also on the board of Restaurants Canada. So we wanted to just talk at, you know, put your chef's hat on, talk at the industry level. But two questions. Take me back to that moment when you and the team are sitting around the table and recognize the enormity of what was going to happen. This podcast, in fact, you know, the genesis goes back to a number of different things, but Sylvain and I were at the Restaurants Canada show, and he and I were both at the show.
That's right.
Which was, early March, March 2nd. And he and I were walking, you know, taking a walk through the aisles, and we're like, do these folks really realize what's going to hit them? And take me back in your boardroom to you and your team when you realized the enormity of the challenges ahead. Was it, you know, first it creeped up on you, or did it just like, was there that one day we went, wow, this is going to be big?
You know, I would say, you know, if I wear my recipe hat for a minute, I would say we probably caught on to it quicker than the industry caught on to it. And so there were a few of us that are part of, you know, larger global organizations that have been, we've got franchisees in Dubai and in Asia. And so as we were tracking what was happening, you know, myself and others that are part of global organizations that are members on the board started sounding some alarm bells. And so when we convened the board, it really was, you know, what are we doing to get in front of this? What are we doing to position when we looked at what the UK was doing, if we looked at, you know, what Germany was doing as an industry, you know, to mobilize government support for what was going to be needed, you know, that became, you know, the pressing focus. And if we look at the two key levers being, you know, rent and wages, advocacy very much focused on those. And so whether that was Minister of Finance office, whether that was small business, regardless of the industry, the chapter, the chamber, Canadian Independent Business, Retail Council, Restaurants Council, it really galvanized, I would say, the industry. So every association that represented restaurateurs, you know, really started to mobilize. And so I think the role that RC plays, which I think is an important one, is to be sort of the central voice and champion. But I would say we probably were a little bit slow to act in the start, and we know that. But if we look at where we are now, you know, we hired a new leader, we mobilized a GR team. And, you know, I think, as I speak for the board, we're all thrilled with what's going on over the last, you know, number of weeks to really become much more vocal, much more on the offense. You know, we believe the restaurant industry has really been unfairly called out, you know, in the media and with public health authorities. And there's really isn't any data to support it. So we've definitely been, I would say, much more on the offense and trying to focus on the public relations side, you know, making sure we've got consumer support for our industry, because that's going to be essential for the survival.
As a board member at Restaurants Canada, I mean, are you pleased with the work that you've done to try to influence policy, to try to influence some of the guidelines being put forward by public health officials? Because I share your frustration, I guess. I've been surprised by some of the measures, and I agree that the sector has been targeted unfairly to a certain extent without really providing any proper evidence that restaurants are really a problem when it comes to public health. Are you happy with what you've seen coming out of Restaurants Canada in terms of the lobbying, in terms of the influence, and are you surprised by how the public has been responding to your work as an organization?
I do think that, you know, most recently, I'm really, really thrilled with what the team has done. I think they've really started to go more towards the consumer focus. It was very much, you know, back of house advocacy. You know, we really needed to make sure that rent and wages and forgivable loans, alcohol being part of takeout delivery, all of those things were important levers to pull. And, you know, I think, you know, depending on jurisdiction, so federally, yes, I think, you know, we've had great concessions in some of those particular areas, more to come, hopefully. You know, we've seen announcements, but we haven't seen details. So rent relief and CEWS are pretty critical programs that we really don't have enough detail on yet. Mm-hmm. We were absolutely at the table, but I think, you know, everyone would like to see more detail. I think provincially, you know, I think we've got, we've had folks like, you know, Jason Kenney at West become very supportive. We've had folks in the East very supportive. You know, I do think Doug Ford is in a hard position. He's got a lot of very vocal public health authorities. And so, you know, I don't think any politician in this country wants to be seen as challenging a public health authority right now on this topic. And so I am understanding to that, but we do need more than, you know, keeping patios open for the winter as a concession in major markets for the industry to survive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you're Chief Pupils Officer for Recipe Unlimited. I'm sure you don't see your restaurants, your facilities as being a danger zone for consumers and employees, I suspect.
No, not yeah. at all. I mean, our industry is tightly regulated, and it always
exactly.
has been. You know, it's always been focused on food safety. It's always been focused on safety audits. I mean, if you talk to your typical operator, you know, they've invested in filtration systems, personal protective equipment, additional staff, you know, division of duties, the cleaning that's been enhanced, as well as, you know, the actual cleaning products that have been enhanced to fight this pandemic. I think, you know, the operators truly, truly, truly have gone above and beyond. But we are tightly regulated and always have been. You know, I do think it's actually safer for people to go to a restaurant where the group size is managed, where there are cleaning, as opposed to people congregating in personal residences where there isn't social distancing, the group sizes aren't regulated, and there's no contact tracing. I mean, we track every individual that comes into our building. So I do think, you know, a regulated environment is a much safer environment than what we've got right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your reading of the Ford government is dead on. I think Doug Ford is really he's been vocal. He's been very supportive of the industry, but at the same time, he has to listen to his public health officials. Quebec, though, I mean, which is the second largest market in the country, has been a surprise to me. I was expecting that the Legault government would be much more open to support the food service industry. Have you been surprised by the tone coming out of Quebec, given, you know, that typically in Montreal and other places in the province, people do go out more and they enjoy some time outside?
Yeah. I mean, I think we were surprised by the extension. I think the hope was that the proof now should be that when the numbers are not
the,
going
the additional
down,
28 days, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. So I think the hope had been that it would not be an additional, you know, 28 days. As we take a look at what's happening too, when you look at the numbers, I mean, clearly, you know, restaurants aren't the cause if your numbers are continuing to go up. And so I think, you know, that holds true across any region. You know, we were safely operating long before schools reopened and all of these other social gatherings came to be. I think the challenge right now for Quebec is also going to be, while there are programs in place, those programs are proving challenging for operators to avail themselves of. You know, so the grants are actually difficult to apply for. So, you know, great that they're providing some support, but for all the operators to actually apply, it is proven quite challenging. And so I think that's going to make it even harder to continue to be closed for another month if you actually can't take advantage of some of the programs that are being offered.
Well, you know, it's been a great exploration of everything from understanding recipe to understanding these, you know, these political issues. It's such a political discussion. I guess our recommendation, particularly from Sylvain's perspective, is open more restaurants in the Atlantic bubble, and then, you know, that there you go. There's your consulting, free consulting advice to the
life.
The
life is pretty much, I mean, life is pretty normal here, you know, despite the masks and the PPEs. But you only have 2 million mouths to feed. I mean, you need large markets. That's the problem, and we have no tourists, and tourists tend to go out a lot. So it's been economically, it's been a bit depressed, even though everyone's healthy, and we have very few cases. Economically, we're going to get hit pretty hard, and so you want Quebec, you want Ontario to do very well to come out of this. We're cheering for Central Canada.
well, great conversation. And Julie, thanks again for your time, and probably one of the busiest people in the industry. So thanks again for bringing us both perspectives, the recipe perspective and the Restaurants Canada's perspective. And thanks for joining us on the Food Professor podcast.
Thank you, Julie.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, a parting comment is, you know, do, if you can and when you can, you know, do go to your local takeout, go to your favorite local restaurant for takeout and delivery. I think everything we can do to champion any restaurant that's in your community, I think will go a long way. I mean, they're vibrant. They're the pillar of our communities. And so I really do look forward to a day when we can all, perhaps the three of us can reconnect over a glass and a pint at a table indoors.
Absolutely. Well, we're a family of six, and we go out often to support our local restaurants. And my own son works as a server in a restaurant here. So there you go.
That's great. Thank you both.
Well, that's a great way to leave. Cheers to all that. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was a great interview, Sylvain. I mean, I thank you again. It was your impetus really early on that said, boy, it would be great to, as I said in the interview, to get both restaurant operators and someone from the association that represents restaurants. And we got both with Julie. So great insights. And, you know, this whole ghost kitchen concept is so fascinating to me, and the mix of brands.
Yes.
And how they have to be careful with those mix of brands, because they've got such a big fleet of brands. I think that must be an interesting conversation around their boardroom.
Oh, table. Yeah. With 60,000 associates, I mean, I'm actually shocked she had the time to talk to us this morning. Yeah. But yeah, it's a massive organization. People don't know it, but my goodness, they have so many well-known iconic brands as part of the organization. So the responsibilities are immense. Given COVID, what's been happening the last 6 months, as chief people officer of the organization, it must have been really hard for her to remain updated, because we didn't know much about the virus. And so as a
novel for a reason, right?
As an HR person, focusing on human capital, you have to wonder, how do you protect your employees? How do you protect your customers? And without the proper science, without clear science. So it must have been really hard over the last 8 months to really understand making sure that everyone is safe as people are trying to forget about this pandemic. Because, I mean, what they're selling right now is an escape, is an escape to this madness, this virus. As soon as you sit down in a restaurant, I've actually done it several times with my family. You kind of forget about it, and you just focus on good times, having a great time with your family, and that's what's most important. And so you have to be thankful for what Julie's doing, what her organization is doing for Canadians. And it's unfortunate that it's going to remain tough for them for a while.
Well, I think they do need to pivot to what Julie was talking about as both as an escape, but also safety. Because as you know, the winter months come into Canada, the patio heater notwithstanding, you know, she makes the very interesting point that it's actually safer in these professional operators versus having people over. If you have a choice to make, you're better off, in an environment where they're so, you could probably perform surgery in half their, in their locations. They're probably so clean now. So, I think that's an interesting point to follow. Speaking of ghost kitchens, I don't know if you saw the news, and there's an article, Heinz starting a ghost kitchen.
That's right. It was funny because Susan Robertson from The Globe actually emailed me to write the story. She was wondering whether or not we had data on ghost kitchens, and we're actually gathering data right now, so we didn't have anything. But I knew that Kraft Heinz actually had a ghost kitchen, but I wasn't allowed to say it. And she was reporting on it, but she didn't tell me that she was reporting on Kraft Heinz. So we both had our little secrets, I guess. It was really funny. And so when I saw the report, I thought, because I had the pleasure to meet with the president of Kraft Heinz Canada this summer, his executive as well. And we're actually we're doing some great work with them on e-commerce as well. And so I was quite shocked when I was told that they had a ghost kitchen being set up in the GTA. So, I mean, this points to the fact that, this blurring line we've been talking about between service and retail. Mm. Well, COVID has blown everything up. There is no line anymore. I mean, everything is possible now as a result of COVID.
You know, for me as a brand strategist, I think about what I order from Heinz. They said in the article, we're just looking to learn. But, it's a really interesting, would I order from Heinz?
But the brand is not Kraft Heinz. It's 57, right?
Yeah. But even, I don't know, eventually people will figure it out. It's a fascinating discussion. It's really interesting to see.
But I think the play is more on the supply side. They want to learn from us. It's not just about making the brand successful at retail or in food service.
Research project? Is that it?
I think it's a lab. It's a lab. And what I've noticed over the last little while is that a lot of CPG companies are looking at pivoting, are looking at engaging with the public differently, and they're looking at selling to us, but no one is really doing a good job at it. Mm. So I actually see Kraft Heinz move as a good one for them. So they can actually do their homework before they actually go with a very broad comprehensive e-commerce strategy, a B2C strategy.
Yeah, I mean, timing's everything, though. I mean, you know, when restaurants are struggling to stay alive, they probably don't need Kraft Heinz competing for their ghost kitchen. There's some thought that they probably need to put into that.
Absolutely. I think they're limiting the number of dishes to 50 a day or something. I can't remember the number, but they are limiting. This is not about revenue generation. This is more about learning and collecting some data, which is something I support very much. I think it's a good step.
Last thing, I noticed Maple Leaf put out some results. I noticed it because I follow you on Twitter. So, you know, I noticed. And what struck me in those results as interesting is they're doing better in some ways than I thought, because I know you and I talked about things like bacon at home not being a big hit. But what also jumped out was the growth in their plant-based protein business. I think it was like 10%. So I guess that's another indicator that plant-based protein business, you know, we've forgotten about talking about, so to speak, all these things over the past month or two, or a couple of months with COVID, but it's still there and it's still growing, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to be honest, I read the report and I was a little bit confused with the plant-based story. So sales are up almost 10%, but they did lose almost $40 million from that division. Mm-hmm. And so they're still losing money. On the other side, of course, with animal proteins, that they're doing well. And they did very well as a result of COVID.
Mm-hmm. That's what I don't get, right? I thought that they would lose more than gain from the lack of food service, you know? In other words, people eat differently at home. So that was interesting to me.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I wasn't overly surprised by results. It's the narrative around plant-based that I thought was a bit ambiguous. So they actually did talk about supply chain challenges, but they weren't specific. My guess is that they've been trying to justify the reason why they lost money on the plant, because they see themselves as a protein company now. It's not just they're not just a pork processor. They're not just a processor. They are a protein. Maple Leaf is a protein company with two divisions. That's the governance of the business. And so on the one side, you're losing money. On the other, you're making more money. And so I'm thinking about the board here and people that are criticizing companies like Maple Leaf, which have decided to actually to go plant-based. I suspect that they're trying to mitigate that and trying to make sure that they don't get too much criticism. I guess that would be my guess in reading the document that came out of the company that was released by the company.
Interesting. Well, maybe we'll get somebody on from Maple Leaf to walk us through all that kind of strategy. That would be a great guest. And speaking of great guests, we have a great guest coming up in our next episode, Peter Van Stock from Spud.ca on the West Coast.
Oh,
He's been a leader in e-commerce. Speaking of e-commerce, so the timing is actually, it's both serendipitous and it's just well-timed for your survey results being released, because Peter's been a leader in e-commerce for a long time, close to a decade in the Vancouver and West market. He's got a warehouse and all kinds of
things. By the time we talk to him, we'll have some data to share. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, listen, let's leave it there. Great episode. If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Please rate and review, and be sure to recommend to a friend or colleague in the grocery, food service, or restaurant industry. I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and host of the Voice of Retail podcast, a bunch of other stuff.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Have a safe week, Sylvain, and everyone, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, bye-bye.